Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two things are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as best-selling and award-winning, or interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. We are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA as well as their fantastic yearly conference at pnwa.org. You know, when I interviewed Anat Banil about 2 months ago, she discussed her work she does with children of all different challenges and her book Kids Beyond Limits, in which she details her 9 essentials that one uses when working with these children the way she does. And I thought when she described these 9 essentials to me that they were applicable really to anyone attempting anything of value. And one of those essentials was enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, without which, in my opinion, nothing really great is ever accomplished. And my guest today, suspense writer John Land, has enthusiasm in abundance, not only for the work he does in his 25 and counting suspense novels, but also for the suspense community in general, both in his work with ITW and his reviews of suspense novel and just overall support for writers old and young alike. And I am just delighted to have him on the show with me today. John, welcome to Author.
Bill, I'm delighted to be here, and in answer to that first question or issue you raised, I have no life. That's why I'm a writer.
Oh, is that, now, I don't believe that.
No life at all.
No, you don't. You are a passionate martial artist, are you not?
I think what you started with, that quote about enthusiasm,
yeah.
What it comes down to for me is the ability to do what you love and sometimes make a living at it, not as much as I would like to at times, but
right.
That is such a gift. And if you're not enthusiastic about that, if you don't appreciate it, you're in the wrong business.
Yeah. Amen, brother.
You know,
amen. I'll tell you, the arts, and I count novel writing amongst the arts fully, I have always said you cannot do it unless you just love doing it. You can't do it just to make money. You actually have to just love the very act of doing it.
Well, Gertrude Stein said she hated the act of writing, but loved having written.
What do you think
about
that?
But she was right. Well, here's what I think. It's the difference between, quote, serious fiction and what I do, which is entertainment fiction. People read me for the same reasons they watch television or go to the movies. They want to be entertained.
Right.
And when you write that way, the first person you have to please, the first person who reads what you write, is yourself.
That's right.
And I go by the mantra that I write what I would read if someone else had written it. And if I'm not my own number one fan, if I don't think my books are the best thrillers out there, and that then it would say to me that I haven't done a good enough job.
Yeah.
That I have let myself down. And if you let yourself down as an author, then you're going to let the reader down. Here's something I've never said in an interview before. I'm going to say it here because I love this format.
Lay it on me.
The two books I was paid the most money for in my career are the two worst books I ever wrote.
Why?
Well, I it had nothing to do with the fact that it was the money. It was the fact that I was with Random House at the time, Fawcett, their Fawcett line, and they had moved a bunch of other authors from paperback, which is what I was,
right,
into hardcover, and they were moving authors who weren't as successful as I was into hardcover.
Right.
And I felt my time was coming, and I signed this new deal, and it didn't come. And their point to me was, we're doing so well with you in paperback, we don't want to mess things up. Well,
right.
If you're there's no in this business, you either go up or you go down. There's no staying the same.
Right.
So I think I felt let down by the fact that they didn't show as much faith in me as they showed some of the other authors. And I think I lost a yard
lost
on my
some enthusiasm.
I lost some enthusiasm, yeah. And maybe I got a little complacent, or maybe the ideas for the books. Now, and one of them continues to get really good response. The other one doesn't. But I learned from that example, and I have not written a book I'm not proud of since. There are some books I'm much more proud of than others, but there is no book I've written in the past 20 that I haven't said, that's the best book I could have written at this time on this subject.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and I'll tell you, if there's one perspective that I interview writers of all genres, from memoirists to poets to suspense writers and romance writers and really every kind of writer there is, if there's one perspective I hear again and again, is that I am writing the book I would like to pull off the shelf. Or, and sometimes it's expressed this way, I am writing the book that I feel should be out there and that I'm frustrated isn't written. I've heard that too. Or they'll read, you know, someone will read a book and say, it shouldn't have ended this way, it should have ended that way. Well, that's them learning the book they need to write. But
well, you know,
always that quality of, this is what I would like to read. Because if you don't want to read it.
No, but here's a caveat to that, and this is an
all
important
right.
caveat. And I made what I'm about to say to you, I said at a Thriller Fest panel, our International Thriller Writers Conference that's
yeah.
in New York every year, I said something at a panel that offended another writer so much he has never talked to me again,
oh, no.
a fellow
all
writer
right.
who I really, and I made the comment in this panel that I would never write a book, A, that I didn't think would sell, and B, that I didn't know how to sell. To the public, meaning that there wasn't some
right.
way, something I could get my hands around. He took offense at that and said, I've never thought of that. I've never thought of, well, who cares if it sells? You write the best book, you write the book. I find that to be a very naive statement in such a competitive business. But that said, I don't think I'm compromising myself, Bill, because I believe that the best motivator for creativity is an idea of the marketing and business sense of what you're doing. My latest character, Caitlin Strong, who is without question the best character I've ever written and the
right.
best character I've ever, the best hero I've ever created. She's a female Texas Ranger. So she's a female action hero, which is very rare.
Right.
And that's what I write, action thrillers, and no one was doing it. But the reason why Caitlin came into existence was discussion with my publisher, Tom Daugherty, and a couple other people in the room, and they were the salespeople. And salespeople have, you know, they care about one thing, can I sell it?
Yeah.
And they were saying, and they made this point, number one genre in publishing today is the thriller. 80% of all books are bought by women. And yet, no one in the room, and this is before Stieg Larsson, by the way,
right?
No one in the room could name a female action hero.
Right.
They could name female mystery heroes. They could name... God, I'm talking about Jack Reacher.
Right.
Lee Child's
right.
iconic
action,
character.
Action.
I'm
right.
talking about James Lee Burke's Dave Robey show. No one could name a female version of that. So I said, well, what about my next book featuring a female action hero? And then the issue became credibility. And I said, I've always wanted to write about the Texas Rangers. Why don't we make her a female Texas Ranger? So here it is. Without question, the best books I've ever written, the best series I've ever written, all with the name Strong in the title, so they're easy to
right.
find, did not come out of a desire by me creatively. It was created at a marketing meeting and gave birth to the character that I then fell in love with.
Except, yes, and I would say that what happened is you recognize in that meeting, you recognize an empty space that you felt within you the capacity to fill. Not everyone could have. Another writer might have said, yeah, it's true, but I'm not going to do that because I can't. But you must have sensed within you not just an opportunity to sell books, but an opportunity to do that because, indeed, you went in there, and as you said, you went and created what you considered to be your best character.
You know, it's a wonderful
Caitlin
point.
Caitlin Strong,
and
right? I mean, her most,
yes.
the most flawed, the most interesting.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes, and
you must
know,
have sensed it. I don't buy it. I don't buy it was just money. Something in
well,
you.
Well, it wasn't
wait,
just, no, no.
Do you know when you start a story, do you know how it's going to end for sure?
No.
Aha! But you know it's worth telling, right?
I do.
Ah, the same voice that speaks to you, that tells you the story is worth telling without knowing what it's about, I would say, although I can't because I'm not in your shoes, I would say spoke to you in that moment and said, go there. There, that's my opinion. What do you think?
I think it's a combination of the two, and I think what you're getting at is this. All artists, all creative people start out by imitating others.
Yeah.
And when I started out, my first, 12 or 13, 14, 15, 16 books, most of which featured, it's been a long
blowing
beginning
things
for me.
Up, right?
Yeah. most of the books that featured Blaine McCracken were, there was a lot of James Bond influence in them. There was a tremendous amount of Robert Ludlum influence, even a little Stephen King, Clive Cussler, all the authors I enjoyed the most, I was copying.
Right.
As you get more into your career, you begin to have the confidence to take risks and chances. Writing a man writing a female action hero is a risk.
Sure.
And I was willing to take it then, and it was something I never could have done 15 books ago, maybe not even 10 books ago. But you've got to be able to grow. And to me, the Caitlin Strong series represents growth because, I would like to tell you that reviews don't matter, that I just ignore them. That's not
right.
true.
Right.
One of the things I love about author is the reviews. And I read other people's as well as write some. And I love the coverage. I love the quality of the writing. That's the thing. I care about what people say about me. It
right.
means a lot to me that Caitlin Strong has been such a critical success. In addition to selling very well, she's also been received very well.
Yeah.
And this I take great pride in because it's affirmation of what you just said about me. It's affirmation that I got it right. An affirmation from a writer can only come two ways, either in your sales figures and in your critical reviews. And let's face it, there's plenty of lousy authors and lousy books out there that sell a lot of copies because
yeah.
– the name alone is selling.
Yeah.
But, there are also wonderful books by thriller authors, my contemporaries, like Lee Child. And Lee gets reviewed on the front page of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section every time he comes out with a new book. And you know what?
Yeah.
Lee Child, David Morrell, and James Lee Burke are not just three of the greatest thriller writers. They're also three of the greatest novelists. And what makes them great is there's not only their consistency, but their willingness to take risks, and that's what I tried to do with writing a female hero, a female action hero with Caitlin Strong.
I think you have to take risks. I think that some of the writing I love is when the writer is willing to push themselves, wherever they're writing, push themselves up against the edge of what doesn't work.
Oh.
So let's say, up against the edge of being sophomoric or up against the edge of not being funny and then taking the chance to walk that line. That's where
you grow,
I think, being a little dangerous.
This is, you just led into something I've been thinking about a lot lately, and that is my new book, Strong Vengeance, which is the fourth Caitlin Strong book,
mm-hmm.
has the scariest scene in it that I've ever written, and nothing happens. And there's no violence.
Right.
The basic premise of the scene is, and this, I didn't know what was going to happen. When I read a scene, I'm not sure. It evolves as I'm writing it.
Right.
Well, I knew that there was going to be a hired killer who needs to provoke Caitlin Strong into showing up at a certain place so he can try to kill her.
Right.
What ends up happening in this scene in Strong Vengeance is she is the surrogate mother for these two teenage boys, the sons of her love interest, another action hero in the book, Court
right.
Wesley Masters, who's in jail when Strong Vengeance opens. Well, this killer pulls up outside the house where she's staying with these boys, and they're outside skateboarding in the front yard, and one of them, Dylan, the boy she has a tremendous relationship with, like a surrogate mother. He's 17 years old, he looks like a rock star, and this guy, as I was writing the scene, wrote himself as a pedophile.
No, but you didn't know
and
when he pulled
scene,
up.
And the scene, I didn't know that. The scene
right.
that goes on, his dialogue, I was getting chills as I wrote it,
yeah.
and I almost went back and said, I can't do this. This is too scary a scene. It's almost like what Stephen King said about Pet Sematary, when he
right.
wrote three quarters of it and put it aside for 10 years because it was too scary. It was the only book he'd ever written that scared him, and he had his reasons for that. But I wrote this scene, and the exploitation of children is a
sure.
very sensitive subject with me. And here, the Jerry Sandusky, I don't have to just turn on any news report and you'll get the Jerry
yeah.
Sandusky trial right now. And that
right.
need we say anything more. But this scene, to go to your point about pushing the envelope and going to the edge, this scene takes the reader to the edge because Nothing is, there's no touching, there's no gunplay, there's no action, there's no
inferred
threat. Everything is inferred, and it's the way, it's what he says, and more important, and this is growth as a writer, the way he's looking at this kid and how that look is making this kid feel inside. And this is a tough, tough kid who's been kidnapped in previous books and has had to fight off the worst serial killer ever in another book. And here it is, and this is what I love about the scene, Bill. He's beaten back this kid has been against all these horrible villains, but he's never been as scared as he is when the guy from somebody who's just talking.
Right.
And that is a scene that pushes the envelope to a level I never could have done or would have done just a few books and years back.
That's just awesome. That's just awesome. And you were dealing with, I've always thought that fear is not what is happening, but what might happen. I mean, I know there are scary, quote-unquote, things.
Hitchcock!
For the people,
you just quoted Hitchcock.
What? Is that what he said? Because that's
Alfred
what
Hitchcock said, suspense lies not in the bomb going off,
right,
but in anticipation of the bomb going
off.
And caring about the characters it may kill.
That's right. It's all about what might happen. It's all about what you, because the mind, the imagination, I go through this with my children, especially my younger children, who get scared a lot. And it is the mind's capacity to invent danger, you know, is limitless. And if you, as a writer, suggest danger, your audience will finish the job for you in ways that you could never imagine. And I think also can finish it in a way that frightens them. If you just suggest the danger, they will then fill in the worst thing possible for them. And in so many ways, you do it such a better service, leaving that frightening open space for them to do what their mind will.
And as a screenwriter, as well as a novelist,
yeah,
the penultimate example of this is, in my opinion, one of the greatest films ever made, and my personal favorite, Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
Because the shark didn't work, couldn't get it on screen.
That's
so
right.
They had to create a movie about a shark where the shark wasn't going to exist. Even the first great science fiction movie ever made was Forbidden Planet, about a monster you never see.
Right.
Because it exists only, and because you never see it, its existence lies in your imagination. So what you're saying is also what Stephen King has said a bunch of times, that no matter how big the monster is, the audience is going to go, whoa, I thought it was going to be bigger.
That's
so
right.
How do you, and the way you get around that is never letting, is in your writing, you never can let the audience down. Because if you let the audience down, if you don't meet their expectations, you have failed as a storyteller. Maybe not as a writer, but you have failed as a storyteller. And nothing is worse than not meeting the expectations. And I'll give you a perfect example. I don't like to. I thought one of my favorite books of the year this year. One of my favorite books of the year so far is the great legal thriller by William Landay called Defending Jacob.
Oh yeah, I just interviewed him. Yeah, he's a great guy.
And you know what? But I'm going to be honest. And Bill, I mean, and William, and it might be Bill also.
Bill,
if you're listening to this, I love your book, but the ending let me down. The ending let me down because it fell off the table. And I knew something was coming because of the structure. But the build-up, and I don't have any suggestions for Bill or William about what he should have done with Defending Jacob, but I know that was an amazing book. But will I buy another William Landay book? I will think twice now, because as great, as much as I love the book, you know, I have to say, the conviction by Bob Dugoni that I'm covering for you next month,
sure. Yep.
To me, is now the best legal thriller of the year, not Defending Jacob.
Well, I'm going to talk to
Bob
him again
Dugoni,
in 3 weeks on this. I'll say that to him. I'm talking to him again here in about 3 weeks
This Bob Dugoni meets your expectations, and the ending lives up to the rest of the book. And it's almost the same book. It's a father defending his son.
Right.
Same story. The difference
You know what it was? That it was Mickey Spillane. He said the first sentence sells this book, your last sentence, or the first chapter sells this book, the last chapter sells your next book.
You know, there's a great Mickey Spillane story I've never forgotten because it goes to the level of violence in thrillers.
Yeah.
And he had done a book where Mickey, where Mike Hammer kills so many people in the climax that he has to reload the machine gun.
Right.
And the editor came back with a comment, ending much too violent. Don't have him reload. I mean, just in other words, kill half as many people. That's fine. And you know, I had an experience like this with when I wrote the latest book, the latest Caitlin book that's out in paperback, Strong at the Break. My last edit, my last read is always my publisher, the brilliant Tom Doherty. If there's a legend left in this crazy business of ours, it's Tom Doherty. He's the last guy who runs his own publishing company, even though it's owned by Macmillan. He has total autonomy. And Tom was coming through Providence, where I live, on his way to Martha's Vineyard. We had dinner with his wife, and he had his notes for me, and he said, you need to change the ending, and you need to do some work. And I said, what's wrong? And he goes, Caitlin's killing too many people, and she's enjoying it too much.
Right.
And I went back to Strong at the Break, and I said, oh, my God. All of a sudden, she's become Mike Hammer.
Yeah.
The body count was incredible. So I took the advice of Mickey Spillane's editor, and I cut out about half her victims, but I totally rewrote the ending. And it's so much better because it doesn't end the way you expect it to now.
Right.
You know, it's, and again, Tom Doherty he's been publishing not just great books, but great stories. And I think that's an important distinction because I'm all about the story.
Right.
And you want to make sure, and the story can never, I'm going back to my other theme, the story you write can never let the reader down. Because when a reader finishes a book, when you finish a great book, you want to feel like, wow, I wish there was more. I can't wait for the next one.
I agree.
And that's
I agree, and I'm wondering, we have a question here from Paula Lanier, a friend of yours, I believe.
Absolutely. What has Paula got to ask me about?
She said, and this I think to some degree goes, I'm in the back of my mind is what Harlan Coben said to me about this question, but I'm going to get your opinion on it. In your opinion...
Great writer, by the way.
Yes, indeed. How involved do authors need to be on the business side of publishing besides marketing? What other aspects of publishing writers need to be involved in on the business side?
Well, I think, in my opinion, the first and most important thing is to be educated. The problem about the business, because what a lot of writers who are starting out don't understand, let me back up. I was blessed in my career to, at a very, very early and young stage, to go on the road with salespeople. When I was with Kensington, Zebra, the great Walter Zacharias, who gave me a chance when no one else did. Walter sent me on the road with his salespeople for my second published book, and I was 27 years old.
Right.
And I learned what it's like to meet buyers from, in those days, Dalton. We went out to Minneapolis. And wholesalers and bookstore chains. And what you learn is everybody is fighting for the same 15 bestseller slots in those supermarkets and drugstores. And everybody is fighting for the same front store display space in the bookstores. And, you know, now it's even worse because the loss of the mall stores like B. Dalton and Walgreens, 3,000 mall stores gone, has made it so much harder to build authors on spontaneous buys as opposed to destination buys.
Right.
These are the kind of things. So I would say in answer to Paula's question, educating yourself on the book business makes you appreciate how hard it is to put yourself in a position to be successful. Because before you can succeed, before you can sell a book, it's got to be somewhere you can find a book.
Right.
And in the second part of the answer to the question, I would say it's learning everything you can about promotion and understanding that promotion is collective. You can't sell a book successfully strictly with social media. You can't sell a book strictly with even if you buy an ad in the New York Times for $90,000, that's not enough.
Yeah,
it's
got to
be a combination of these things.
Yeah.
A symbiosis. And I think it's authors have to realize if you're just expect you're going to write and put it out and it's going to sell, well, then you're going to be really, really lucky.
right.
not just good.
You've
got to
be able.
You know,
and what Harlan said, interesting, what he said about this was, his side was, now, he felt, yes, it's good to do your social media and track this, but he said, still the number one thing a writer needs to do is write the next best book again, and write another good book, and write another good book. And that, because that, and when all is said and done, he felt that's the thing that you have the absolute most control over. Right.
You know, I could not agree with my good pal Harlan more. Could not agree with him.
Because all that stuff helps, but you do have to write it. It does help a lot if you have a book. Because you know, John, the best way, it was Donald Moss, who I first heard talk about this, that one of the best ways a book sells is when I say to you, John, you know what you got to read? You got to read this new suspense by so-and-so.
Word of mouth. But you know something? The industry has undergone a paradigm shift, Bill. By the paradigm shift, part of it, there's a lot of things, but John Grisham used to say the number one, the most important thing about being a best-selling author was publishing a book at the same time every year. But now that's not true anymore, because big names are publishing more than one book a year, and others are doing these Kindle things where they're doing bridge books, or you know, somehow connected to the series. So there's what that means is there's a lot more pressure on the big names, and unfortunately, to keep it coming and do more, and unfortunately, a lot less opportunity for lesser names. To take those, because if I'm buying three Lee Child books a year, well, actually,
you
only get one year.
If I'm buying everything by
Clive Cussler's 87,000 authors that are writing for him and Jim Patterson,
well,
then maybe I'm not buying Bob Dugoni, and maybe I'm not buying Harlan Coben, and maybe I'm not buying John Land, but I usually buy all the John Land books, obviously, because somebody asked me. So, you know, this is one of the paradigm shifts challenge. Of authors, you know, it's, and you talk to any wholesaler in the country, leave, you know, and they're going to say, I'd much rather have a second John Grisham, Harlan Coben, Jim Patterson book every month than I would another author who doesn't sell as consistently. You know, everything is about space. Everything is about competition.
Nice.
So it's important, again, and this goes to Paula's question also. What Harlan says is 100% true. It's just not as impactful as it used to be because of the realities of this business.
Yeah. Well, it's all shifting anyway because now, of course, it's going more and more online. And what does that mean? We don't know yet, do we? Now, space.
Well, I can tell you what it means.
It may not mean diddly do anymore.
Your
e-book sales have got to be at least 50% of your sales now, right?
Not mine. No, that's my problem. I have not hit that level in e-book my contemporaries have hit. And, you know, it's a different kind of selling with the e-book. And the problem is that the big authors, and this isn't just me. My publisher has shown me figures that are scary.
Right.
Big authors are selling huge numbers of e-books.
Right.
Mid-list authors and low, whatever you want to call me, lead title, quasi pseudo best-selling authors.
Right.
Really, it hasn't yet hit.
Not yet.
The problem is, and here's what I was going to get at. The problem is that book buying used to be spontaneous. You used to see a book that looked good and you'd buy it and you would fall in love with that author. I can't tell you how many authors I discovered because of great covers and display space at the mall bookstores and supermarkets. Paperback. I did my first 16 books in paperback, so I know of what I speak. The e-business that you just alluded to is not it is a destination business. It is not a browsing business. And this is the fear we all have to have. The big guys and the big gals are always going to do well. But how do the rest of us get noticed in an era where it's very much harder to be discovered?
And if only we could answer that one today. But we can't. John, what a great chat. You have got so much knowledge. And so much love of this industry. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. And I got to tell you, what a great format to come on and talk about writing and talk about the industry and talk to people who love books and thrillers. A great opportunity. I'll come back. I'm ready to do this again tomorrow. Let's talk again.
Excellent. John, thanks again. It was just a treat.
My pleasure.
We just lost him. John, I'm so sorry about that. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. It's been a great show. Remember, write what you love. Do what you love, you really can't go wrong. See you next week.